Zero Hype episode 28. We are back and we are here to talk about everything that happened on TV this week. And there is a lot to talk about because a lot of really big things happened. So, as always, if you want to get involved in the conversation with us, you can do so by getting hold of us on Twitter, which is at Hero Hype Podcast. You can leave a comment for us on this post when it goes up on hypebull.com, or if you want to, you can send us an email, which is herohypepodcast@gmail.com. As always, I'm back, I'm Danya, and I'm joined by my co-host Caitlin.
Hello!
So, let's get right down to it, and this week we are going to be kicking things off with a brief history of Cameron Chase. So, Cameron Chase lost her father, the Acrobat, a hero working for a low-level team, when he was murdered by Dr. Traps. After this event, Chase dedicated her life to seeking justice and became an agent of the DEO, the Department of Extranormal Operations, which is a branch of U.S. intelligence. The DEO is employed to monitor metahumans and the supernatural and eliminate threats where necessary. She doesn't have much fondness for powered beings due to the unfortunate circumstances around her father's death. She's highly skilled and has worked with many heroes across the DC universe, including Martian Manhunter, the Suicide Squad, and the Teen Titans.
So, why are we telling you about Cameron Chase? Because she is coming to Supergirl, and she will be played by a fan favorite Buffy alum. So, Emma Caulfield will be playing Cameron Chase on Supergirl. Pause for applause.
Yay!
So the character description is that after her father's violent murder, Cameron Chase decided to dedicate her life to law enforcement. Now a stern, no-holds-barred FBI agent, Chase's weapons of choice are manipulation and manpower. With little sympathy and plenty of suspicions, she pursues her targets with ruthless determination. So, that's interesting. She sounds like an intriguing character.
Oh yeah, definitely. And yeah, it's cool that they're going on with a slightly different origin for her as well.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how close they stick. Obviously, we've kind of seen that Superman is the only other hero in the world that they've set up. So he likely was not a low-level hero who was murdered by a villain, but there's plenty of crime in the world. And she went into the FBI instead of the DEO, which is interesting since the DEO is actually an organization that exists in the show.
Yeah, but it's also nice to separate that. So we've got two characters already who they're going to have and develop as part of the DEO. And I would guess give them the bulk of the storylines of that. And I guess balance out between what they're required to do in regard to superpowered humans or metahumans or the supernatural or even aliens, as Kara herself is. And kind of obviously because Alex is very, very close to Kara and has that kind of almost conflict of interest, they're going to play with that a lot more through the season and what is right and what is necessary. So it's good that they're going to focus on those characters as part of the DEO and Hank Henshaw as well and everything going on with him, rather than trying to add another character into that mix and almost kind of dilute that storyline down a little bit more. Like, it's going to be more interesting to have her separate to that and introduce her through other means and kind of give her different motivations for why she's doing what she's doing.
Yeah, I'm betting they're going to have the FBI, like, working with the DEO on something. Like, maybe there's a murder case that the FBI starts on, and it turns out to be one of the Fort Ross escapees, so they have to cooperate with the DEO. And maybe her father was murdered by one of the Fort Ross escapees, and that's the connection.
Yeah, and maybe she doesn't necessarily know the whole story behind it. She just thinks it's a kind of a normal person or a normal, well, it's a normal murder. No murder is ever normal.
Yeah.
But yeah, it would be interesting to see how they're going to connect it all together. But could you imagine the DEO and the FBI having to, like, work together? It would be like, you know, when you get local police officers and the FBI or local police or the FBI and the CIA, you know, like when you have to get two differing organizations within some kind of law enforcement or government having to work together, and you've always got that kind of butting heads thing.
Yeah, and these two groups are probably groups that are used to getting the quote unquote smaller organizations to cooperate with them and them being in charge. So they'll be like butting heads with, no, I'm in charge. No, we're in charge.
Which will be absolutely hilarious to see. So I'll be looking forward to that and what they do with it.
And quality casting choice with Emma Caulfield's Buffy represent.
Oh yeah, it's always nice to see Buffy alums in new projects. It's because I love that show so much. So
and it's appropriate with the whole girl power female superhero thing. So I like it. I like it a lot.
Me too. Yay.
All right, so speaking of Supergirl, we had an interview with EP Andrew Kreisberg, whose name you should recognize from Arrow and the Flash as well, because these people are extremely busy and can't stick to one show. So after the last episode, Kreisberg was talking about why they had Kara and Astra come face to face so early. And he talks about how they've never gone wrong bringing in the big bad soon. We've obviously been having a great deal of success with Neil McDonough on Arrow this season. So yes, that's been working quite well. And he just adds that your hero is only as good as your villain, and your villain has to have a chance of killing the hero, otherwise there's no jeopardy. When you have someone like Kara, who's Kryptonian and can do anything Superman can do, you want her to go up against a true adversary, and having her fight another Kryptonian felt like the best way to do that. So it sets up the danger that she's in from the very beginning. So I agree. I thought that was a smart move.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly smart as well, because obviously, without having that and developing your villain, there's like, you're not invested in it. And the thing is that the threat isn't there if you don't develop them enough and show their motivations and what their goals are. And without those solidly set out, you just have a villain that kind of falls flat. So, and especially with this one, with Astra specifically, like, it's so important because she's so linked to Kara's past, and there's obviously a lot of emotional stuff that's going to go on with that. So introducing her so early is going to impact the show and Kara, because it's her family, like, or well, one of the few remaining parts of her family. And even though Astra is kind of like gunning for her in a not so great way, well, at least she's come face to face with Kara, whereas her dear cousin apparently will kind of foist her off on everyone else. He who must not be named.
Though they did add more of his name in the second episode.
Yeah, the first episode, it was just hilarious that they kind of
danced around. And they did add a mention of his name in the first episode from what the screener, like all the stuff that was aired pre-airing, I guess didn't have it at all. And the final airing version actually had at least one mention of Superman. So they did notice, I think, some of the people being like, it's super awkward, and they changed it a little bit.
Yeah, it was incredibly awkward.
But they mentioned Clark Kent twice in the second episode. Yeah, but for the rest of the interview, Kreisberg just kind of was talking about Astra's motives, and some people have theorized that she's trying to establish a new Krypton on Earth, and Kreisberg says she's not doing that because it's been done and they wanted to do something different. And he adds that she really believes she's here to save the Earth from the path that the humans have set it on, because she saw what happened on Krypton. So she's one of those people who is very devout in her motives, and she believes what she's saying. She just likes to slide it under the rug that a lot of people are going to die in the process of doing what she wants to do. So that'll be interesting to see what she is really up to.
Yeah, and I mean, if her goals align or her final outcome aligns with Kara's, I've said it before on previous episodes, I always find the narrative of the villain and the hero's ultimate goals overlapping. So them having the same kind of eventual outcome for what they want, but the means in which they get there differing greatly. So almost where you stand on the scale of do you operate in black and white or shades of grey. So it's always really, really cool to see a villain and a hero who kind of are wanting the same sort of thing, but, you know, one will go to extreme lengths to achieve it, and the other kind of is more morally upstanding. that's probably a good way of putting it.
Yeah, so kind of the rest of the stuff in the interview I think we'll get to with the episode discussion, but he was just kind of elaborating on things that happened, like the glowing eyes and what's up with James for the rest of the season and all that good stuff. So it's a good read. I recommend checking it out. And we will talk more about Supergirl very soon. But before that, we're going to switch over to Arrow. After the Constantine crossover episode, Mark Guggenheim told us that, sorry, Danya, there are no plans to bring Constantine back. This was always designed to be a one-off. So, sorry.
I know. And I guess more than anything, it's a shame, because having him in the show just highlighted how well he worked in that universe and how it just, it all clicked together. Like, it just worked really nicely. And obviously, Matt Ryan, who plays Constantine, is just an amazing presence on the screen. Like, his comedic timing is, like, fantastic. So he's always incredibly enjoyable to watch, and it's just such, it's a shame that potentially we're not going to see more of him, because NBC stuffed everything up, basically. I'm not NBC's biggest fan, honestly, with how they treated the show. There's actually a piece of feedback that we'll get to later in the episode that kind of just almost sums up a lot of why I'm still really mad at NBC, but we'll get to that a little bit later in the episode. not to be left out of the casting game, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has added a new character to their roster. So, Mark Dacascos has been cast for a recurring role as S.H.I.E.L.D.'s head of security, so chief of security even. So he's going to be a character named Guerra, who's going to be working very closely with Coulson. So they haven't given us much more than that. But if anyone is an Iron Chef America fan, you will recognize Mark Dacascos as the chairman from that show. And Iron Chef America is quite possibly the greatest cooking show on the planet, aside from the Great British Bake Off.
You would.
What? It's true. He's also been on stuff like Hawaii Five-0 and Dancing with the Stars and Stargate Atlantis, so he's been on a couple of things, but it's going to be really cool to see him on S.H.I.E.L.D., because if you've ever watched Iron Chef America, like, his persona, his character, the chairman that he plays on that show, is so, like, cheesy and over-the-top ridiculous. It's amazing. Like, I really love it. So, yeah. And obviously, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. could use some security, considering all of the people that keep infiltrating it and kind of using all of their information against them because they're getting it ahead of them. So, you know, he's got his work cut out for him when he's joining S.H.I.E.L.D.
Let's hope he's a new hire.
Yeah.
Because if he's been on the job, he's been doing a terrible job.
Yeah, he should be fired, not kept around if he's been there the whole time. I would imagine he hasn't been there the whole time, because after the reveal from this week, S.H.I.E.L.D. definitely has a security problem. So we can get, actually, let's get right into talking about the S.H.I.E.L.D. episode from this week, because we need to get
twist.
Yeah, so don't we have egg on our face? So after all of that thing of, like, screaming about Ward and that we would never forgive him ever if he had killed Andrew, and then we get the reveal that Andrew might even be worse than Ward in regards to, like, killing and maiming and murdering and literally going out and potentially committing genocide of sorts. So, Andrew, Andrew, really? I mean, I know. Both a stroke of genius and very upsetting. Because I always really liked that Andrew was like this grounding presence in the show. That he was just this constant throughout everything where people got very overly emotional and driven by kind of personal vendettas against other characters, or things got out of hand. And, you know, that there are characters within the S.H.I.E.L.D. team that feel so deeply, and things kind of get like very drama filled and very over the top sometimes. And Andrew was just always this calming presence that kind of drifted along in the background that was just really nice. It was almost something that brought it all back down. And I always really liked him. And, you know, now we find out that he's been playing us better than Ward probably did. So, depending on when he became an Inhuman, whether that was prior to the fish oil thing and he's literally been playing the long game the whole time, or whether this is an incredibly accelerated vendetta based on him ingesting a fish oil capsule. But I can't see them going with the latter, personally. How about you?
The timeline doesn't make sense because of how deeply personal that sort of finding in humans who aren't worthy of their power idea is. Like, that's very deep and would be something that comes from years of hatred, I would imagine. So having him swallow a fish oil capsule and that be his motive really makes no sense. But I guess my question is Andrew working on his own, or is somebody else pulling his strings?
I mean, considering how terrifying Lash is, and so on, I can't imagine there's going to be someone behind that again. I actually think it would be more interesting to kind of have it just be him working alone and him having everyone thoroughly fooled. Like, everyone fell for that, Ward included, considering he targeted him as someone close to May and literally went after him thinking that, you know, he wouldn't be able to defend himself. So, I don't know. It's going to be really interesting now that we've got that reveal, how it's going to play out, both his motivations and what they're going to do with that, and how this came to be, when it came to be. Like, my mind is still blown. Always thought that it was potentially going to be someone involved with S.H.I.E.L.D. somewhere, like a character we already knew, because they were always too conveniently one step ahead of them. Like, whenever they were specifically going to be going for someone, Lash was always just that little bit ahead of them. Not by much, just ever so slightly. So it just made sense that it would be someone that we knew who either had access to the same intelligence as S.H.I.E.L.D. or was part of S.H.I.E.L.D. So when this theory started coming up online, I started rewatching some of the earlier episodes and I saw where it came from and I was like, well, they could go with that. They could. I really hope they don't, because, you know, May's been through enough already at this point. Can we not? But, yeah. What can I say? Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. keeps upping these stakes.
And I have to imagine that the team is going to find out, like, well, May already knows, so they're going to bring that back, like, in the next episode. So there's not going to be a prolonged time of them being fooled by Andrew, which is good, because that gets tiresome when you're sitting around, like, ominous music playing as Andrew ever says anything, like, at the end of the episode. So it'll be good that they just go with it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, I think it's going to be good now that it's going to be straight out there. Because, I mean, it's a second huge stroke of, like, betrayal for this team. It's someone who has been so involved and has helped them so much and has, like, literally put himself in the heart of that team and has really strong connections with so many of them. Like, he's helped Coulson through, like, really damaging emotional stuff. He's potentially even sat down and helped other characters off screen as well. So it's someone who's, like, really ingrained himself into that team. And you know, it's definitely going to drag back up that trauma, paralleling what happened with Ward in season one. So it's very interesting to see this come back around full circle and see them see this happening again. And I guess, like we were saying with the casting of this chief of security for S.H.I.E.L.D., they really could use with that security and pretty sharpish. Other things that happened in this episode is that Bobby is back in the field, and that little scene where May comes charging in and literally starts attacking her, and she's having to hold her own, and she eventually gets the upper hand on May, and May is like, okay, so you are ready then, and Bobby's all like, well, technically, like, I'm not completely healed, and you know, the doctors have said, you know, shouldn't really be going back in just yet. And May's like, yeah, you've passed all my tests. It's fine. Suit up, basically. And I was so glad to see Bobby back in action. Like, I didn't know how much I was missing it until that moment.
I was glad to see Bobby back in the field, but I was rolling my eyes at May for this, like, entire episode, because, you know, if Bobby isn't cleared, then there could be something that comes up with her knee where she is somehow vulnerable in the field. And even if May's like, oh, you passed my test, what if, you know, the doctors are usually right? So I have a feeling that, like, it's gonna snap or something in the middle of a mission, and it's gonna be like, I told you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it kind of, even though with May it's not the right thing to do, it also highlights how emotionally involved she is in this, and how for once that may be clouding her better judgment. She's too close to this situation. She's too driven by her emotions to kind of compartmentalize this time round, because typically you would expect May to be able to separate that. But it could also be frustration with the fact that Hunter is literally just doing, like, really stupid stuff that's jeopardizing a lot of people. And I mean, you know, she's very much aware of how competent Bobby is, and she's weighed up the potential risks long term with the payoff short term, and decided that for her, in her head, she's willing to sacrifice that potential long term thing to get what she wants in the short term, which is actually a really interesting angle to be taking with May, because it's not one that we probably would have expected from her, because she's usually very level-headed and able to shut down that sort of thing and just realize what's best overall. So, yeah, eye-rolling, like you said, but a different angle to her.
I mean, there's the scene in the bank vault where Bobby's trying to talk their way out of it, and May just immediately resorts to violence. And I get the point she was making, that you need to be ready at all times to fight. But, like, dropping violence in the middle of a high-security bank is more likely to get you caught than sweet-talking the bank manager. Like, that was really dumb. Really, really dumb.
Oh, yeah. But then this kind of plays into the theme of this kind of season as well, which is the inhuman theme, and what makes you human and what makes you inhuman. Like, it's just going to be really interesting to see all of these, like, flaws in humanity kind of playing out, and tensions getting higher and higher. And now that this whole thing with Andrew has come out as well, how that affects everything. Because if we thought she was emotionally charged and pissed off, it's going to be nothing compared to this. Because thinking about how she reacted, how she shut down when everything came out about Ward in season one, after, like, obviously they had that very short-lived kind of physical relationship, and then everything that he did against the team, Andrew is different. Andrew is very, very close to her heart, and that doesn't happen very often for me. So it's kind of, for me anyway, going to be interesting to see how this plays out in regards to her humanity and how she can be kind of very deeply flawed when her emotions get the better of her, which is a very human thing to happen, and especially playing against the whole what makes you human, what makes you inhuman theme we've got going this season. Like, that's, I think that's going to be quite interesting to see play out, even if we don't necessarily agree with her methods or her motives.
Well, it's quite ironic that she kicks Hunter off the case for being incompetent when she is essentially pulling the same stupid moves that he was.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is that she's so blinded she can't see that. And I guess Hunter is so not happy in this episode. And
God, Hunter.
I know. It just... Yeah.
But he comes up with a brilliant idea to test the guy's blood, and their faces, like Mac and Daisy, were like, oh, that's really smart, actually.
Yeah.
That was hilarious.
I know. It's brilliant. Actually, those three working together was absolute genius. Like, it just worked so well in this episode. I absolutely loved it. Like, I kind of like what they're doing this season, and they're not going with the same characters that have always been paired up all the time. They're changing it up. So you're seeing different combinations of characters working together. And it's just been really kind of cool, personally, to see all of these different people working together and how they achieve the goals that they've set out and how successful they are. But
yeah. How or if.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. But obviously with their kind of side mission, this trio, this wonderful trio who kind of go off because they've got Daisy's got a suspicion of who Lash is, and it's one of Rosalind's agents, and what was his name? Was it Banks? Was that his name? I remember it begins with a B, but basically she's completely convinced that it's him. It has to be him. It can't be anyone else. And she's got tunnel vision with it. Like, she's written off any other possibility, and she's like very kind of narrowly focused on the fact that this is the only guy and we just need to prove it and then we're done. Obviously, it turns out in the end that it's not him and they find that out, but they do see something else entirely, which is when they catch Coulson with Rosalind when they are placing inhumans in suspended animation. And so they're doing this because they are basically going to do that until they find a cure for their inhumanity, for their powers to basically make them human again, which is a very interesting thing, like a kind of another thread to be playing out in this season, because, you know, a lot of the people who've been triggered against their will would probably want to take the cure and go back to their normal lives. I mean, obviously everything that happened in the pilot will come back around because a pilot, the premiere episode, not the pilot episode. It's not a pilot episode every season. What am I talking about? jeez. I mean the first episode of this season, obviously, but, you know, we'll see that play out because all that guy wanted was to go back to his ordinary life. He wanted to go back to being normal again, and I guess we're going to see the whole thing with Daisy basically being like, no, it's like a gift, it's something special, you can do such great things with it, there's so much good we could be doing. But it's the same as like kind of the cure storyline within the X-Men, except I guess the difference will be in X-Men, it's a genetic thing, it's a mutation, it's basically the next evolution of humanity, whereas with the Inhumans, they were specifically created to be weapons, and then they escape and basically set themselves up separate to that in order to kind of reclaim their own agency, almost. And it's not something that will just develop naturally. It's it has to be something already present and then triggered after the fact. Like, it's not just going to come out on its own. You have to specifically go through a process in order to manifest those powers. So it then becomes like a choice, a physical choice. You have to be informed in order to make it, whether or not you want to go through with it. And obviously this fish oil thing has taken that option away from so many people, especially with how widespread it's going to be when they had that map and it showed like where it's gonna pop up in like a certain number of months. And yeah, it's just gonna be really interesting to play it out, because it's so different from the typical kind of storyline we would have seen with the X-Men theme that we've had previously in some of the X-Men movies. So yeah. What did you think of this whole storyline coming out when we saw what Rosalind was up to?
Well, it felt to me like both sides of the equation are going about it the wrong way. Like, they really should be going after only the Inhumans who are causing a problem. Like, Lincoln only went off when he was attacked, and he was just fine until that point. And if they left him alone, he would just be himself. Like, he doesn't want anything to do with this. So they're pushing him to be more dangerous than he would be on his own. So it seems like they should be looking at the Inhumans who are active, or they find are active, and are give them the choice. So these people who freak out with their activated powers, who want it, have the option to go into the stasis. But those who would like to, you know, figure out their powers could go with Daisy and kind of hone their powers and not be psycho evil. Like, it seems like there's a midway point between both sides.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting to see if that's going to pan out, whether eventually that compromise is going to be reached, depending on like how closely S.H.I.E.L.D. will end up working with Rosalind. Like at the moment, it's going to be a very clear divide, and you're either on one side of the line or the other. But obviously with the threat of Lash there, and potentially all of this new Hydra threat happening as well, you know, it's kind of one of those things where it's like, compromises may have to be made eventually in this season as threats from certain angles come a lot harder. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how this eventually plays out, and whether or not... Obviously, Daisy's incredibly unhappy with this, so it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, because she's not going to let it lie forever. Like, she's either going to confront Coulson, or she's going to confront Rosalind about this. And it'll be interesting to see how they may or may not compromise, because Rosalind may even go full tilt further because of the Lash situation when that all comes to light, and Coulson becomes aware of who is involved again. And if Rosalind finds out that it's another infiltrator into S.H.I.E.L.D. that's basically getting the drop on them, she may go, you know, full tilt on this whole suspended animation thing. So yeah.
But it's interesting that they're not killing people and experimenting on them, like was sort of implied at the beginning. They're just...
Yeah.
The whole Kier thing is interesting, in that Rosalind has this kind of sad backstory of her husband, who was not an agent of any sort, died of cancer at a young age. Like, that's too bad.
Yeah. It'll be cool to see, like, it'll be interesting to see this playing out over the rest of the season, because we've got some really cool underlying plots through the entire thing. So, yeah, we've got, on the one hand, Lash kind of going around and taking out the unworthy. We've got Daisy trying to save and hone and make them all work as a team. And then you've got Rosalind, who wants to present a cure to them and basically place them in stasis. And these three things all are working against each other, and at some point something's going to have to give. And I think the most likely thing is that Rosalind and S.H.I.E.L.D. will actually have a full cooperative relationship where they have to compromise in order to stop Lash, essentially. And maybe, I don't know, whatever Ward's up to. Like, that whole thing is happening off somewhere else, separate to everything. But yeah, It's interesting to have so many forces in play this season, because it's all starting to link together, but keeping track of everything is kind of like, whew.
Yeah.
Speaking of things happening off somewhere else, so Fitz is carrying on with his simulations with the Monolith, but isn't being very successful with it, so he's not making much headway there. But he's also researching Will, which I thought was not incredibly surprising, because obviously he would want to make sure that that all checks out, you know, what he potentially has told Simmons. So I thought that was quite interesting. And obviously it was incredibly heartening to kind of see Fitz continuing on with trying to bring Will back, which obviously carries on from the previous episode.
Well, yeah, and Fitz is a scientist, so knowledge is literally power for him. So the more he knows, the stronger sort of he is. So it makes total sense he would be looking up what happened.
Yeah, but for now, we don't have too much more of that, because obviously the other stuff took up the bulk of this episode. And yeah, obviously the Lash reveal being the biggest, the biggest, oh crap moment from this episode. And yeah, I guess that's everything from the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. side, unless you've got anything to add.
No, I think that covers it.
Yeah, right. It's DC time.
All right, shall we start with Supergirl?
Yeah, let's go with Supergirl.
All right, so the kind of core plot of this episode is that Cat Grant wants a sit down with Supergirl, who has been struggling with her superhero image because she keeps trying to help and she keeps messing up. Like at the beginning of the episode, she tries to move a tanker so it doesn't blow up because there's a fire, and then she causes an oil spill in the process. So trying to stop one problem creates an even bigger problem. So poor Kara. And then, of course, we've got all the media coverage as being like, is she a menace? And Kara's obviously taking this personally. So we're kind of dealing with whether Kara's going to do the interview, and Cat Grant is trying to get James to use his connection to Superman to get the interview, not knowing that Supergirl is standing in her office the whole time. So that whole thing is going on. So what did you think? Are you surprised Kat is looking for a sit down with Supergirl?
No, not at all. I mean, from the pilot episode, we knew that what she wants to do is obviously make Supergirl for her media empire what Superman is for the Daily Planet. The one thing that kind of really surprised me is how harsh she's being about this. The thing is with Kat is that having Supergirl as this, having, almost the monopoly on Supergirl means that she gets to create the narrative here. She gets to basically turn the tide of public opinion one way or the other. Like, she is in full control here. And yet, she's kind of being really hard on everything. She kind of brings up the whole thing of, where she started in the Daily Planet and having to, get coffee and do so and so in order to work her way up and claw her power and so on and so forth, and having to do these really terrible things in order to get there. And then she's faced with this kind of amazing thing that she could be doing, and in that she's already got all the power now. What she could be doing is, instead of saying Supergirl should really be doing these kind of smaller feats, not doing these big, huge kind of sweeping gestures of bravery and so on and so forth, she literally controls the narrative there. She almost controls public opinion. And it was just really interesting to see her talking about that like it's completely out of her control. I was like, no, it's completely in your control. Whatever you put out in those papers is essentially what people are going to end up thinking, because they'll parrot it back. You see it every day in tabloid papers and newspapers and everything like that. So it was interesting to see what direction that they're going to be going with her in. I don't know what you thought of all of that.
I thought it was interesting because Kat kind of seems to be taking the whole Supergirl thing personally, and it feels kind of like with her bringing up her own backstory and giving advice when Kara asks what she would tell Supergirl, that she's kind of projecting her own struggles as a woman in a male-dominated field onto Supergirl and wanting Supergirl to be the ideal for women in something, in a field that you expect men to be in, because superheroing has been Superman's thing all this time. And now we have a woman in the field, and it seems like Kat wants everything. Like, she wants her to be, she wants Supergirl to be just as good, and is sort of taking it personally when she's not, because of her own struggles. And I find that interesting that she, I feel like she has a personal connection to this character essentially that she has created, and I don't even know if she realizes it, but it does seem like there's some kind of like personal projection of her own struggles in male dominated fields going on here.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing with that is that she is the woman, she is a woman in power. She is someone who's managed to build that up for herself. And the thing is that once you get to that point, you get to turn the tide of how things work. Like, you get to be the game maker then. You get to be in charge of how you shape and mold other women coming up behind you. So this whole thing of being, like, super hard on Supergirl is kind of, it kind of doesn't make sense, because she's almost mimicking what a male would do in that same situation, rather than trying to place herself, I guess, almost in a role of mentor in order to pave the way to make it like a little bit easier to transition into that role, and kind of almost build it up into being a more positive narrative, because, you know, she has full control over that. You know, it'll be interesting to see how that might change as we carry on through the show, because she almost represents an almost old school feminism view of like tough love and kind of, I've struggled through all of this, so you don't understand until you've struggled through all of this as well, and if you don't immediately achieve this, I'm going to be really hard on you, because it should be easier for you now because we've already gone through all the struggles. Whereas instead of doing that, instead of like being that guiding force, it's a really interesting thing to kind of be playing in the narrative for me.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how that conversation goes, because we see at the end of the episode that Kara basically kidnaps Cat Grant's car so they can have their conversation. So I'll be interested to see how that goes and where they go with that.
Yeah.
But Kara takes kind of what Kat says to heart and decides that she's going to tackle some smaller issues and start improving her image. So she enlists James and Wynn to help her. And there's a great montage with a great musical cue. And she does some small-time superheroing, including rescuing Fluffy the snake from a tree.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. It was just the... You're saving a snake from a tree. Well, okay.
Don't name their snake Fluffy.
You know what that would be? That would be a very Hagrid thing to do.
Oh my god, it's true. But this is a great little scene, and you start seeing kind of the growth of what's going to be Supergirl's Scooby Gang.
Yeah. Which is their reaction to, like, he knows kind of thing.
They're pointing at each other.
Yeah, I thought that was great. Because I guess for both of them, they each thought that they were the only one in on the secret. And to discover that she's let someone else... I think for Wynn, probably more like, well, why... Like, why him? We're best friends. He's just, like, he's just rocked up. What's going on? Kind of thing. And there's probably a little bit of that one-sided relationship thing playing in there. But with James, it was just the looks on their faces that had me going. It's like, him? Really?
And when Wynn comes out into the alley and James is already there and they're trying to awkwardly kick each other out of the alley while they're waiting for Kara, like, it's great.
I know. I thought it was brilliant.
I quite enjoy that. And Wynn is clearly getting jealous of James, and James is like not aware of it because he's just so earnest that he's like not even aware.
Yeah. I like the direction they're going in with James as well. I think that's a very interesting narrative to be taking with him, like a direction to be taking that character in, that almost, I came here to get away from being just that guy who only became famous because of Superman, and now he's being used to kind of be successful in his field by being the guy who's going to get Supergirl. Like, it's very interesting to see the insecure side of him, almost, that unsure attitude of, am I successful just because of the company I've kept? Or do I really have the skill and talent that put me in this place, like, put me in this place in my career in the first place? Like, which is it? And that kind of almost, it's almost like an identity crisis of sorts. And I kind of really like that they're doing this almost, that kind of vulnerability is usually reserved for a female character, that being so unsure in your ability when you are incredibly skilled, you know, that's a storyline that you don't often see for male characters. So I'm absolutely fascinated with that being the direction that they're taking James in, and it's going to be really cool to see how Kara affects that.
Yeah, that interview we were talking about earlier, Andrew Kreisberg kind of said that, was saying the same thing about what they have James doing is essentially the traditionally female role. He was saying that James is basically the Lois Lane of this series because he's going to be being put in dangerous situations when Kara has to rescue him, and he's being very emotionally vulnerable. So they're very aware of that's being the position they're putting him in, and they're doing a really good job with it. And I think what I really enjoyed about that scene at night when Kara has heard that Kat threatened to fire James if he can't get the interview, and she agrees to do it for him, and he gives her the heart-to-heart, that if you watch his face when she's talking, like, you can see the gears clicking. Like, he's really, his perception of her is altering in that moment, because in the first episode, he's very much seeming like wise mentor type. Like, he's there to be supportive. And even in the beginning of this episode, he's very like, wise mentor, you can fill Superman's boots. But then it cracks. And the fact that she never judges him and just gives him this lovely advice about the honor of taking help, like, you see his face and he's looking at her in this brand new way. And I was really fascinated by just watching his expressions there. And I think they're doing a good job of putting these two characters, if this is going to be the relationship they go with, on really even ground, because in the last episode he was supporting her, but then in this episode she's supporting him. So they become emotional support very evenly to each other.
Yeah, I don't have much more to add to that, because it's just so on point. That, like, that, like you said, that whole scene was really well done. Like, it was just, the emotion in that was beautiful, and just them, the chemistry that those two characters have together, whether or not they take it in the direction of it turning into something romantic or not, like, regardless, the place where they're at right now is a very interesting place in how they're going to affect each other. And I'm really interested to see how this is going to play out, because it's such a great thing. We're two episodes in and they've set up this completely fascinating place for both of these characters to be in relation to each other. And it's just, I'm so eager to see more, because, yeah, they just work really well off each other, so.
Yeah, I think major props to both Melissa Benoist and Macaud Brooks, because they're doing a killer job. But as much as I ship the two of them, the core relationship we see is still Kara and Alex, which I'm super appreciative of. That interview from earlier also talked about how that is going to be what drives the show, and that you don't really see adult relationships between siblings on television, or at least adult relationships between siblings where they're not competitive or estranged, or just where they're not, where they're on good terms with each other. So they're doing something fairly original in just exploring this relationship between two adult women who are sisters. And again, they're aware of that, and they know that that's a very important relationship to explore. So they're going to keep it at the forefront. So I appreciate hearing that they're so aware of the importance of keeping the sisterly relationship at the forefront.
Yeah, agreed. Like, it's so very much the entire heart of this show. It is what so many people are going to connect with, because you don't see in a lot of these shows relationships between women where they keep building each other up and pushing each other to be the best that they can possibly be. It's not something that you always get. You can sometimes get that competition, that underlying competition plot, and them trying to drag each other down, and especially in regards to like sisterly relationships, you do get that rivalry, or sometimes even that kind of them not getting along all the time because one or the other feels like they're in their shadow. And yes, we got a little bit of that from Alex, but she rises above it and kind of moves on because there are more important things than kind of basically letting that destroy that relationship. The other thing that I'm really going to be interested to see is this idea of your family by blood versus your found family kind of thing, because obviously they're setting up James and Wynn as part of Kara's almost found family. They're very clearly setting them up as going to be very close. And I guess it's going to be nice to see Kara and Alex's relationship and how that plays out versus Kara and Astra's kind of relationship, in regards to that being very antagonistic and them coming up against each other and Astra as the big bad. So yeah, I think that's also a really interesting thing to be playing through this season.
Agreed. I wrote about that in my recap of this episode, that I'm looking forward to that. But speaking of Astra, kind of the main thing is that Kara and Astra come face to face, and Kara thought that Astra was dead, that she had died when Krypton exploded, and Astra reveals that she was on Fort Roz. Because what's interesting here is that she says that she was imprisoned for speaking the truth, which makes me think of kind of the General Zod story.
Yeah.
Of them knowing that Krypton was in danger and then being imprisoned for daring to tell the truth. So I'm guessing that she's probably a part of that story, or maybe she's going to be the forefront of that story if they can't use Zod in the show.
Yeah, that would actually be quite cool, because if they do go with that, then obviously they're gonna, because we've so recently had Man of Steel as a thing in this universe, people are going to connect the two, whether or not DC want this to be a connected universe. So if they do go with that, it's going to be quite interesting, especially if they vaguely reference it in show without explicitly saying anything, depending on like what they can and can't say because of like movie rights and what DC want them to say or not. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, because I will imagine that we are going to maybe flashback at some point to what happened with Astra before she was imprisoned. I would imagine that we'll get, you know, these shows, they like their flashbacks. These guys,
true.
You know.
Yeah, and having a scene with both twins in it would give them all the more Laura Benanti to have on the screen, which they seem to be really loving so far. But yeah, so the first thing they do is, when they come face to face, is Astra decks Kara, you know, lovely reunion there. But I think what's just so interesting here is that, you know, Kara recognizing that it's not only her blood family who's behind the threat, but it's actually identical to her mother, who, you know, she was so close to. And then we have the hologram at the end, or the AI that looks like her mother but can't give any physical affection. And then you have the one who looks exactly like her is your complete antagonist. So that goes back to the blood family and found family, and Kara having to get her emotional needs met from her found family, but it's just, it's got to be hard for her to deal with the fact that their villain looks identical to her mother.
Yeah, I can't imagine that's going to get any easier either.
But we had a pretty cool looking fight, and Kara manages to use some tips from Alex to hold her own. And then Hank Henshaw shows up and stabs Astra with a kryptonite dagger, and she runs away. And later we see Hank Henshaw's eyes glowing red.
Dun, dun, dun.
So in the comic books, Hank Henshaw has an identity. I guess it's in the comics. We can just say that he is Cyborg Superman in the comics. Mm-hmm. So he was a former astronaut who was exposed to radiation while on a mission. And the entire crew except him committed suicide. And he transferred his consciousness to a cyborg that looked just like Superman because he blamed Superman for the whole thing. So I don't know how much of that they're going to use, but it's there in the background.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very heavily implied. It's like, we see you, comic fans. It's kind of, this may or may not be a thing that we're going with. You will find it.
It's going to be the Harrison Wells of Supergirl.
Yeah. They've got to have one in all the shows.
Yeah, exactly. But so we don't know much of anything. We don't even know if he knows that his eyes were flashing red or if that was purposeful. Like, we just don't have enough information.
Yeah.
But the whole Cyborg Superman is his comic identity. But if you read my article about this, you'll know Cyborg Superman has two identities in the comics. And the other one is Kara's father. So they could very well play with that, too. So I'm very intrigued to see where they go with this.
Yeah, it's such early days as well, and there's so many directions they could take it in. It's just gonna be, it's this show, just it almost the way that the Flash, when the Flash first came out, it's so joyful. Like, it has that same joyful feeling that the Flash had when it started out, and I'm just so happy with it. Like, I'm so, like, I really loved the pilot episode. I thought it did have its hiccups, its moments where I was like, you know, but episode 2 was phenomenal. And you kind of think, well, if that's the trajectory that they're on, if these episodes are just going to keep getting better and better and better and better, like, damn.
I know. I'm very excited. I really enjoyed this episode.
Yeah.
So, well, speaking of the Flash, shall we talk about 205?
Yes. Let's go with it.
So, otherwise known as Harrison Wells is a dick.
Yeah.
That was kind of my takeaway from this episode, is that Earth 2's Harrison Wells is really awful.
Yeah, he really, really is. I don't like him very much at all.
I'm surprised it took as long as it did for somebody to punch him in the face.
Yeah.
Because I did not blame Jay at all for decking him.
Because
he was horrible.
He really was. And it's just kind of like, when Jay did that, I was like, oh, finally.
But yeah, so Earth 2's Harrison Wells is here because he has taken responsibility for creating Zoom and wants to help defeat him. So there's that. And so we have kind of that going on in the background where he and Jay do not get along. We saw a flashback to Earth 2. Jay publicly called out Harrison Wells for creating all the metahumans. And there's just a lot of backstory there. And they do not like each other, even a little bit.
No, and I mean, understandably so. You know, it's created what is a mess of problems for Jay, and now transplanting it over into Earth 1 as well. So, you know, the fact that there's this tension there isn't all that surprising once that's revealed. So, yeah.
But yeah, so the metahuman of the week is Dr. Light, who was kind of a small-time thief who got powers and got some pretty cool light powers, which she uses effectively. But she's been sent by Zoom to kill the Flash. But Barry discovers that is Earth 2's Linda. So that explains why we saw Linda earlier. They're just reminding us that she exists.
Yeah, I actually am really interested with where they're going with these, like, all of these doppelgangers coming over, almost. Like, they're all, like, characters that are, well, for the majority of them are already established characters. And, essentially are kind of getting closer and closer to the team. So I'm almost worried that the end game here for Zoom is to be able to replace one of the people closest to Barry at some point without him noticing, and then use them to get the upper hand or get enough to get close enough to achieve his ends. Like, yeah.
Well, he's trying to kill Barry straight up now. So what would be the point of getting close if he just has one of the metas kill him?
I mean, obviously that's not working right now. So it's not going particularly well, that method. So there's got to be a shakeup somewhere where he changes tactics.
Well, we see in the promo for next episode, they're going to use Linda to bring in, to lure Zoom, which I'm looking forward to seeing. And oh my god, those promo stills, he is terrifying.
He is. Caitlin sent these to me via Facebook message. It was yesterday evening, and I was basically freaking out. I was like, no, send it back to hell. Where is Constantine when you need him to banish him? Demon.
He was demonic, and they were saying before the season started that, like, when they first saw the suit, they were like, this is terrifying. I was like, how terrifying can you make a Flash suit? Oh, they made it terrifying.
They really did. The mouth. I think it's the mouth that kind of almost, it's almost mummy-esque in the fact that it's almost, like, completely, like, partially preserved but degraded, kind of, like, it's, like, from the actual mummy movie. So if you see, like, the mouth when he kind of opens up, and it's, it just looks so freaky and so terrifying.
And what's really fascinating is that he's wearing a suit identical to Barry's, except, like, drained of color.
Yeah.
It's really creepy. And I wrote a piece speculating about who he might be, and I have my favorite theory. Do you have any theories yet?
I don't have any theories yet. I would like to hear yours, though.
So I looked at a few, but my favorite theory is that he is Earth 2's Henry Allen. That, because I thought, you know, what if he's Barry, but Zoom is too big. Like, he's too bulked up, so he doesn't, unless Earth 2's Barry is significantly bulked up, that's not going to work. Thought maybe he might be Earth 2's Eddie. That's another potential. Or Earth 2, or no, I was going to say Earth 1's Jay, that somehow Earth 1's Jay got sucked over, because we haven't asked, does Jay have a counterpart on our world?
I was actually thinking that this episode as well. I was like, we're starting to see all of these the other way around. So we're seeing all these Earth 2 characters come here, and a lot of the Earth 1 characters are already established, but Jay is a character that we don't know from Earth 1 yet. We haven't met. We haven't met him on this side, so...
So what if he got sucked over to Earth 2 somehow and became Zoom? I don't know. That was another thing. I thought that would be kind of a repetitive mentor betraying Barry story, so I'm not 100% sold. I also thought it could be Earth 2's Joe, because of the kind of West-focused season that we're having. But my favorite theory is Henry, because he disappeared, so that's kind of like, and then he comes back and is evil, because what would be harder for Barry than spending over a decade trying to prove that his father is innocent of a murder, and then the Earth 2 version actually is a murderer?
Oh, man.
And John Wesley Shipp was Barry Allen, so letting him play a dark speedster would be kind of a cool nod to that.
It would, and he's an amazing actor, so giving him more content to work with and basically pushing him in that, that's actually, do you know, that actually would be heartbreaking, but it would, oh man, that would be so, if you turn out to be right again, I'm just going to be like, what's in your water, Caitlin? Is it all those peaches? Is there something in the peaches that you guys eat out there?
Obviously. But that's my running theory. We don't have enough information, but I feel like it has to be somebody we know, like the doppelganger of somebody we know, because what's the point of bringing in all these doppelgangers? because they could do the Hunter Zolomon route, but we don't know him. And it's going to have a lot more resonance if it ends up being the doppelganger of somebody we already know.
Yeah. So. And it's also going to be... The other thing is, like, giving those actors that we already have on the show the kind of scope to be able to play someone who's almost opposite, is almost a mirror to their character, like, but complete opposite. So it flipping that personality, flipping everything to, like, be different to how they are, like, Earth 1, Earth 2, like, literally switching that around. So it's, oh, man.
So those are my theories. I think it'd be cool if it was... Earth 2 Joe too, but Henry is my current pick. 5 episodes in, there's a lot to go, so, but yeah, so that's where I'm at the moment. But I guess the other thing, major thing that happened in this episode was that Sisko is finally outed as a meta, because Harrison Wells has an Apple Watch that identifies metal humans and basically, so he finally admits that he has these powers, and his friends are really nice about it, as we all could have told him they would be.
Yeah, I can kind of understand him sort of keeping it under wraps, though, because his actual powers are really interesting, but it's... I mean, Harrison Wells is a dick, though.
Oh my god, he's the worst.
It's this whole thing of, like, Sisko would have been ready at some point to do that himself. Like, once he's, I guess, almost come to terms with it on his own. I don't like this idea of someone revealing something so deeply personal about someone without their consent. Like, it's not cool. I hate it. Because they need to feel comfortable, confident, and safe in that environment. I'm not saying that Sisko doesn't feel safe and comfortable around his friends, but you know.
It's his secret to reveal.
Exactly. And I just... Harrison Wells, man.
Gross. He's just doing what needs to be done according to his views. And then he does that horrible thing where Sisko can't get the visions to work. So Sisko already told him that the other Wells shoved a hand through his chest. So he shoves the helmet into his chest, like mimicking that. That was... so cruel.
It really was. Like, I don't care what you wanted to, like, what you wanted the outcome to be. I don't care if that put you on the trajectory of getting what was required. But that, you know, pushing that and creating that kind of trauma for a character is just going to make them more unstable and the powers more unstable. And that's not going to be good for anyone if that happens. Like, Sisko is very much like a huge part of the glue that holds everyone together of sorts. So, you know, I hate that he used that against him. I hate it.
It was really cold. I did love that Barry is the one who came up with Sisko's nickname, though.
Yes, that was adorable.
That was so cute.
It really was, because it's always Sisko coming up with the names and stuff, but... to have that turned around and have someone, like, give him a really cool name, it was adorable.
Speaking of adorable, Barry and Patty! Oh my god, they were so precious. They went on their first date, and of course Barry goes suffering from temporary blindness, so he tries to have Sisko help him through the date with the glasses and an earpiece. Which is Sisko giving running commentary about the date. Hilarious. But Patty figures it out, which is, she's like, I wouldn't be much of a detective if I couldn't tell. But it was super cute. And they kissed. And I love the two of them. I think they are really great together.
And they're exactly what the other needs right now. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's timing-wise for where they both are at. They are exactly the right, like, right place, right time, right people for what is needed right now. So, in regards to the show, I think this is, like, the perfect relationship to be playing in the background of this season while everything else is going on around them. Like, I just think this works so well for both of them.
Yeah, I really like what they're doing with the two of them. So much love. This was a really good episode of The Flash, but they were saying before the episode aired that they kind of saw this as a two-parter, and it definitely shows. So next week is Enter Zoom. So gird your dreams from nightmares.
Yeah, I think as terrifying as the stills are, I think it's going to be even more so when it's in motion.
And they'll have some creepy music to go with it. And I'm so excited. But shall we move on to Arrow? I know you have a lot of feels. So I'm just going to say, Danya, go.
Okay. This episode was amazing for me. Like, I absolutely loved it start to finish. They had the perfect amount of sass for Constantine, the perfect amount of quipping, the magic in the show, which I may have been slightly dubious about them going full on mystical. It worked for me. Like, I think it was just the right amount. And the thing is that they didn't have Constantine explain it too much. So the bewildered looks of everyone as he's like chanting and using like Latin to create spells when he's doing all of this stuff, and you've got everyone giving him the side eye of like, what the hell has this guy been smoking kind of thing. It really worked because no one truly seemed to believe through the entire episode that what he was doing was legitimate. They all thought, like, this guy is just crazy. Where has Oliver dragged this guy from? And yeah, I just loved it. I loved every little detail. And for anyone who didn't see Constantine, who didn't watch his show on NBC, the introduction of him at the start in the flashback, like the music that they played as he turned, as he was revealed, and he says his first line, like that is the opening notes of the theme for Constantine's standalone show. And then when they move into the bit where they go into the spirit Lazarus pit, like on the other side, on like the sort of in the spirit world kind of thing, they did a reprise version of Constantine's theme, which is by the phenomenal Bear McCreary, who does pretty much every amazing TV theme and soundtrack that's out there, including Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So, yeah, I have nothing but amazing things to say about this episode. And he had so many good lines as well. Every single line he had was just like, bang, one-liner. And I was just so happy with it. I was expecting slightly more of him. Like, there was slightly less of him on screen than I was initially expecting, but every time he was on screen, it was complete gold. He just, I see what they meant with it feeling very organic. Like, he fit in perfectly for me. So, and breathe.
Yeah, I didn't watch Constantine, and I don't have any intention of watching Constantine. Sorry, Danya.
I know.
But, I mean, I enjoyed him. I feel like I was missing an inside joke a little bit, but for the most part, enjoyed him. But I have my own priorities about this episode, such as it says in the doc, in all caps, my princess lives and has a soul, because Sarah.
It was really cool. It was, I actually really liked just the whole thread through this episode. Like, Laurel and Oliver coming to blows over what's happening with Sarah. And I mean, they both kind of have valid points at one point or another, but it was really interesting to see how both of these characters have changed from how they treated each other in, like, season one, season two. Like, this episode really highlighted the changes in all of these characters. Like, it was just, it was astonishing. Like, I was looking at the screen going, these are the same characters that we were introduced to who were so petty and kind of almost vindictive in regards to each other sometimes in season one, and look how far they've come. And I mean, especially Oliver. Look how far Oliver has come at this point. Because, yeah, he apologized.
He has really turned over a new leaf. Like, they kept saying that he was going to be a new person this season, like him going off with Felicity for a few months, like changed his perspective. But the fact that he listens to her, like basically calling him out on being awful to her, which he has been, listens, realizes she's right, and apologizes, shows like he has grown so much as a person in the last like 6 months. And I appreciate that so much.
Yeah, same. And you kind of see Laurel realizing a little bit as well, is that maybe even on her side a little bit, even though she's living with what she's done, this was her decision to make. And she was basing it on the fact that she didn't have enough information to make a fully informed choice, or at least the information, or the most information that she had came from Malcolm, which, as we know, is an unreliable source. So, you know, she's having to live with the fact that the blood of the people that Sarah has killed, essentially, is on Laurel's hands right now, because she's the one who went forward with bringing her back. That was her choice, based on the fact that, you know, even when Oliver is calling John in to help with this situation, when it's gotten completely out of hand, he's still, for the most part, withholding a little bit of information and what he knows. And so it's, even though Laurel realizes potentially what she's done may have not been the best thing, like you see it in the scene where she ends up leveling the gun at Sarah and being like, you know, no, you were right. This isn't right. It isn't her anymore. And it's never going to be her. She has no soul. You know, you see the weight of that responsibility on her shoulders, like the gravity of what she's done kind of coming down on her. And yeah, it was really interesting to see them both accepting that mistakes have been made. And yeah, this episode was fascinating. I absolutely loved it so, so, so much.
Yeah, I think it can only be a good thing for the show, especially as it's becoming more Green Arrow, that Oliver and Laurel as Green Arrow and Black Canary are actually equals.
Yeah.
So even if they don't take these two on a romantic ride, which I don't feel like they can anymore.
Like, no.
I think they wrote them with too much baggage in the past, and Oliver is ready to propose to Felicity. So I don't know that they'll ever break Felicity up and have him get together with Laurel at the end. So even if they just stay as friends, I think the fact that they're finally mending their relationship after all these years, because this was kind of the culmination of all the baggage between them, that they can finally truly be equals in the field, I think that's only going to benefit a Green Arrow story.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's just nice to be able to see, like, this is the line in the sand almost, and now they can move on from here, because both Laurel and Oliver see in each other the willingness to compromise, except when either of them has been wrong, and move past their stubbornness, because they both can be as stubborn as each other. You know, Laurel isn't completely innocent in this. She could have, when she brought Sarah back, told Oliver straight away to try and almost nip the problem in the bud and try and come up with a different solution. Because even in the previous season, when he kind of became the heir to the demon sort of thing and went on that, like, he would have found out more about what was happening with the League of Shadows, League of Assassins, and so on and so forth. And he has that information there. The fact that that relationship was at the point where she felt like Oliver would be less likely to give his support and help and more likely to judge her, and that's what swayed her from telling him what happened with Sarah. Like, it's just so interesting to see them moving on from that and realizing each of them where their mistakes are and kind of moving forward from that, which I think is huge character growth for them, for the both of them.
Yeah, I agree. This was a good Laurel and Oliver episode.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to take a second to be like, I was totally right about Sarah attacking Thea, because Thea is the one who killed her. So just, you know, hey, another true prediction.
Yeah, yeah. Something in the peaches. Something in the peaches, I swear.
Sarah is back. down her soul, which was being held in something that looked like the Lazarus Pit. So that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think
Sarah has a very interesting relationship with water. If you think about it, like she drowns, quote unquote, twice. And she is resurrected by water and her soul is being held by water. So it's intriguing to me in the symbolism with her.
Yeah, it really is. I thought the whole thing with them going between worlds, going back to get Sarah's soul back, I thought the whole point was that was like the direct parallel of the Lazarus Pit, like in that spirit world. Like I thought that's what they were going for there, that her soul was being held in the spiritual Lazarus Pit that's connected to the one that was in the physical world. Like that's what I thought that they were going with there, so that's why it looked so much like it.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Sarah's back and she'll be hitting the field next week, which I'm very excited about.
Yes. It'll also be interesting to see whether or not that bloodlust continues, or whether because she's come back a different way to the way that Thea came back, whether that's completely eliminated that.
Well, the episode synopsis tells us that, but...
Oh, I haven't seen the episode synopsis, so that's my bad then.
Basically says that they go out to rescue Rey, and Sarah's Lazarus Pit bloodlust almost ruins everything.
Okay, there we go.
So she still has it.
Okay.
But I think that both Sarah and Thea need to kill Malcolm, and that will sate their bloodlust, because technically he's the one to blame for both of their dips in the Lazarus Pit.
Yeah. So you're going to
take Malcolm out, then that'll cure everything.
Yeah, you're going to keep going with that theory until they prove you right.
Because it's true.
Yeah.
And Malcolm is the worst. But the other thing that happened in this episode is we find out why Hive had Diggle's brother killed, sort of. We find out from Hive's point of view, anyway. We don't know what the full story is, but we find out that Quentin is able to get out from Damian Dark, that Andy Diggle was, when he was deployed to the Middle East, was apparently into some not-so-legal activities in the area where Hive was also active, and that's what it was. They were really vague about it, so we don't specifically know what activities, but just that they were less than legal, and that's why he was targeted.
Yeah, which is a really interesting thing, because for Diggle, obviously, this is a breakthrough in that now he knows why his brother was targeted, but also kind of shakes up his view of his brother, in that if this does turn out to be legitimate, which Lance says that, you know, he's followed up on it and it is legitimate, like what is in this file is true in so far that he's been able to ascertain, like the fact that, you know, Lance is like, you have a choice here. You can either remember your brother as he was, as you saw him, as you believed he was, or you can learn the truth about what really happened. And it's just heartbreaking that this kind of view that Diggle had of his brother as being this hero to him is kind of shaken to its core by figuring out that what he was doing essentially was, we don't know the full story yet, but essentially setting himself up as some kind of crime lord.
But we also want to keep in mind that this was Hive's file, basically, that Diggle was looking at. So
yeah,
they're not necessarily the most reliable narrator either.
No, they're not.
I'm sure there's going to be more. I'm sure Diggle is not going to just take that and be like, okay.
Yeah.
Because that's not how Diggle acts, nor should he. So I imagine we'll find out there's a lot more to the story than that. But we have beginnings of a story for what happened with Diggle's brother.
Yes. Yes, we do.
All right, so any other Arrow thoughts?
No, other than Constantine.
Sarah!
I think this was a good episode for both of us.
I know. We both had our favorites.
Oh, the thing where Thea is saying to Oliver, like, oh, he's a very specific kind of yummy, killed me. Because Oliver's reaction of, please, never say that again, Ever. Please don't. I don't need to hear that. Like that. I don't need
to hear a sister talking like that.
Yeah. But it just, I just loved that moment. Just, I thought that was brilliant. But not my quote of the week, because I've got something else for that. But we will get to that in a moment. We are just going to breeze through these movie headlines, because there's not a lot. There's just a couple. The first one being the Marvel Press, who obviously came out with the Black Widow novel very recently, is expanding the list by coming out with some new ones. So there is going to be an Iron Man novel, which is going to make Karen very, very happy. We're also, obviously, was already announced that Captain Marvel was going to be written as well, but Shannon and Dean Hale, who are writing the Captain Marvel novel, are also going to be writing a Squirrel Girl novel, which is the one I'm most excited about from this announcement. So, obviously, I believe I recommended Squirrel Girl at some point for everyone to be reading, because it's amazing. But the Iron Man one is going to be written by the Artemis Fowl author. So if there's any Artemis Fowl fans, like, that's going to be quite cool. But we are also getting a Rocket and Groot novel as well. So, and it's going to be called Rocket and Groot Stranded on Planet Stripball. So that's going to be quite interesting. But you know, have you read the Black Widow novel?
I have not. I saw Danielle had a not so favorable review on Goodreads, and that made me sad.
Oh, really? I kind of enjoyed it. I thought it was quite interesting, and it's getting a sequel novel. So I don't know. I feel like people will take it one way or the other. I think it's worth a read anyway. So I quite enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to the sequel novel as well.
I'm putting it on my to-read list, which is massively long.
Yeah, I know. They always do end up being, because every one book you get through, you add 10 new ones to your list. Yeah.
Real books, like books and comic books, yeah. All of the above.
Yeah. The other thing that we got from the Marvel side of things is that, obviously, Doctor Strange has started... it's almost like it's location scouting, initial filming stuff. So they've caught Benedict Cumberbatch on set in Nepal. So where we were discussing a couple of weeks ago the fact that they were getting rid of potentially the Tibet backstory because of wanting to corner the Chinese market, therefore potentially this whitewashed cast is in the aims of basically retconning the entire backstory of him and all of these characters coming from like an Asian background and having this Asian mysticism and power and basically becoming the white savior and everything of this particular area. Doesn't look as though they're doing that. They've just changed the location. So, yeah, it's moving back into problematic territory from where I was maybe getting settled into the fact that, you know, actually they may not be going in that direction. Yeah, apparently they've just replaced Tibet for Nepal so that they can do the same thing, but change the location so China doesn't get mad at them and still shows the movie. So, yeah.
So, Danya's still unhappy.
Yeah, I mean, it is inherently problematic. It's a narrative that they've done with stuff like The Last Samurai as well, which that movie was so problematic. Like, taking a huge culture and making the white person the most adept at it and the savior of these people. Like, I have huge problems with that. Just in general, because, yeah, we are not the be-all and end-all. It's very self-centered to think that these people can't have their own heroes, their own people who are, like, the best, like, and are, like, the pinnacle of this power, this whatever, this skill that they have. And it requires a white person to come sweeping in and be the very best, like no one ever was, for a Pokemon reference. just because. But yeah, I don't know. I'm Gonna still keep my eye on things, obviously, but at the moment it's kind of swung back around full circle to potentially being a whitewashed backstory in an Asian setting. So, yeah, watch this space.
I advised Danya the other day to not let her blood pressure skyrocket over a movie that just started filming, because she'll probably explode before the movie comes out.
Yeah, and it's I sent Caitlin the new Iron Man comic, Doctor Strange has popped up in it. And the thing is with that, they're doing so well with the Doctor Strange depictions and like how they're representing him on the page and like his exasperation with Tony Stark just in general. And it's just so interesting what they're doing with him in the comics. And then I'm getting this like whiplash back and forth of like absolutely loving him in the comics and then being completely despairing over the direction the movie is going in, because I love Doctor Strange. I really, really do. It does have its problematic origins, even in the comics. And I've always maintained that the movies are the opportunity to fix that. But, you know, I'm always more and more disappointed when they don't take that opportunity. But, hey, I guess at least I've got the comics. So, bright side.
The tagline of everything. Yeah. At least we have the comics.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of white people, we'll move over to DC. And we have Nicole Kidman is rumored to be joining Wonder Woman. And all they're saying is that it's as a high-ranking Amazonian warrior, though the theory is currently that she'll be playing Hippolyta, the queen of the Amazons, and Diana's mother. So there wasn't any proof that that was the case. That was just the speculation. But it looks like Nicole Kidman may be in Wonder Woman.
Which is fairly interesting in regard to her stature. Like, she is very, like, she's very statuesque. She's very tall. She's very imposing. Like, she's over, I believe I remember seeing that she's over 6 foot tall. Like, so, you know, she does embody in certain aspects the physical attributes of an Amazonian.
5'11".
She's 5'11", yeah, she's almost 6 foot then, so she's very tall. That's very tall. As someone who's 5 foot tall, that is tall. Like,
that's tall to me, and I'm 5'7".
Yeah. So, yeah, the great thing about the Amazonian warriors from, like, the comics is that they come in all shapes, all sizes, all colors, so it's going to be interesting if we see, like, a vast array of women in the Wonder Woman movie, especially because it's looking like it's going to be set prior to Batman versus Superman and Man of Steel and all of that. So I'm interested to see how they're going to round out the cast of Amazons. So,
and Nicole Kidman's a big name, and it always helps the prestige of these superhero shows to have, or superhero films to have, big names.
Yeah.
Them, so I have no problem with it.
No, me either. And I really like Nicole Kidman as an actress, I think.
Same.
Yeah, I think she's wonderful. Like, I always thoroughly enjoy seeing her on screen. So, yes.
Good actress, so good addition.
Yeah.
So watch the space for confirmation of who she's playing.
Yeah, because for now, we don't really know one way or the other. But that's it for movie news. So we're going to move on to our quotes of the week. So Caitlin, I will let you kick that off.
All right. So mine was from this week's Supergirl. It was kind of tying back to that discussion we had about women in immense space. And this is kind of where my feelings about how Cat Grant feels about Supergirl come from. She says, "I'm so sick of hearing about the Man of Steel. Every woman worth her salt knows we have to work twice as hard as a man to be thought of as half as good." So I thought that was a great quote and continues to show that the people who are writing this know exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, they really, really, really do. My quote for this week is actually one that it depends on how clued up you are on the whole thing behind Constantine and all of that. So I've been wondering what on earth was up with that peacock feather when it showed up in one of the stills the Constantine on Arrow stills. And I was like, I think I remember saying it on the episode, like, I don't even know what's up with that feather, but Constantine's weird, so, like, whatever, it doesn't matter. No, it did matter, because it turns out when Felicity hands him the peacock feather, and she's like, I don't know what you need this for, and he's like, oh, yeah, no, that's great, and, like, grabs it, and he puts it down the back of his shirt and, like, scratches himself with it. And then turns to Felicity and says, nice one, that's been bugging me for hours. Like, it was the subtlest non-subtle dig at NBC that I've ever seen, because obviously their logo is a peacock. So I just thought it was brilliant. Like, I can't believe that they got away with putting that in, but...
And the trivia behind that line is that they didn't script that part. They scripted the peacock feather, but then it was just kind of a throwaway. But they were saying after the episode that Matt Ryan improvised itching it and having a line with it. So that was all Matt Ryan.
I freaking love Matt Ryan so much. He's like, he's from Wales. He's from, I think I was telling Caitlin this the other day, like, he's from the village over from mine. And yeah, it turns out my parents know his parents, which is like, this is how small world Wales is. But you know, it's always nice to see Welshman doing well in
I always get so distracted when I hear Matt Ryan's name, because that's the name of the quarterback in our hometown football team. So I'm always like, how did our quarterback end up starring on
do you know what do you know what trivia moment, I knew that because when I had Matt Ryan and Constantine on alerts, because I was covering Constantine on Hyperbole, I would always get another Matt Ryan popping up, and I'd always be like, "I don't mean
Falcons
that one,
Matt Ryan."
Yeah, I'm like, "I don't mean that one. What are you doing?"
When I was first seeing the headlines, I was like, "Wait, our quarterback is doing what?" And I was like, "Oh, that's an actor with the same name. Got it."
Right. Quotes are done. Let's move on to Comic Corner. So, doing something a little bit different this time around. So, Matthew actually left a Twitter comment saying, so excited for Iceman's storyline. Got any recs for LGBT characters? Now, yes, I do. I have a few issues with the Iceman thing that happened. So essentially, to give anyone who isn't following the comics a quick rundown, essentially, Iceman, who had previously been in relationships with women through the comics and kind of so on and so forth, is outed by Jean Grey, who pries into his mind, essentially, and figures out that he's actually repressing the fact that he is gay, and outs him, essentially, and forces the matter, which I have massive issues with for, obviously, similar reasons for why I was mad at Harrison Wells for the Cisco situation. You know, that's not anyone's secret to tell other than the person. You never do that. No one ever should have that outed without feeling comfortable with letting that information out. So while I do have my issues with where they're going with Iceman and that whole thing, and now that it's actually confirmed that, yes, he is actually gay. I do have a couple of ones that I really, really love. And it is a 50-50 split, guys, between Marvel properties and DC properties. So Midnighter on the DC side is one that I highly recommend. It is probably one of the best portrayals of a gay superhero in mainstream comics, like, so far. Like, it's so great. I mean, Midnighter himself is kind of a little crazy, but he's always, like, his sexuality has always been like a massive key part of the character, you know. He did have a long-lasting marriage to a character called Apollo, but when the new 52 reboot happened, they were split up and weren't aware of each other's sexualities, so the fans weren't particularly happy about that. But you know, his solo series, he's single again, and kind of they've been teasing that he's going to get back with Apollo. But there's also this kind of tease across in the Grayson series, which is Dick Grayson, the original Robin. There's also a tease that Dick may be bisexual. So If you do go on to read Midnighter, I'd also highly recommend picking up Grayson, because the characters switch and move over between the two series, and it's very interesting to see where they may or may not go with that. It's very heavily hinted right now that Dick Grayson could be bisexual. They haven't explicitly stated right now. The other one, obviously, is Batwoman. Batwoman is just... I don't even know where to begin with that, because she... When they first went with that and went with Batwoman as, like, being, like, on the LGBT spectrum, like, I just... It was so great, because you don't tend to see them really going there very... Like, having a lead character being potentially in a relationship with another woman and kind of, like, treating it very sensitively. And it just... It was such an important series. Like, it's so good. You can't pick and choose with that. You've kind of got to read a lot of the Batwoman stuff to get it, because it kind of goes through everything. But that's another one that I'd highly recommend. The other one is two team storylines that I've obviously recommended very highly previously. So first one is Runaways. Runaways is very interesting because it has a relationship between what are two female characters, Carolina and Zarin, who is actually a shapeshifting character, and they don't have a defined gender. They're very fluid in regards to how they appear. So it also takes on that very interesting kind of introspective, like, what your identity is in regards to your gender. Like, Zevin is very flexible with it. When Zevin first appears in the comics, they appear as a male character. But when they start getting attracted to Carolina and wanting to pursue that, and Carolina's like, look, I'm a lesbian, I'm not interested. Zevin's like, oh, okay. And then changes forms to be more female, because they don't have a defined gender where they're from. It's just whatever they potentially feel more comfortable with at that time. They literally flick between how their physical body represents them. They don't. And Zevin basically not changes themselves, but in order to pursue the relationship and make Carolina feel more comfortable with pursuing it, like, kind of takes on a form that makes her more comfortable. But it's very interesting. The way that they tackle that is very, very, very cool. And there's also a lot of hints that some of the other characters may not be completely straight either. So yeah, Runaways is also another one. And lastly, Young Avengers, which has a gay couple, Billy and Teddy, through the entire first bit. But also, as we've carried on going through, we have a lesbian character in the almost the second series iteration of Young Avengers, which is America Chavez, and she is defined as a lesbian. That's on the page now. She definitely is. And Kid Loki is bisexual, and that's confirmed. And you also have kind of up in the air at the moment, Kate Bishop, may also, who is Hawkeye, female Hawkeye. She may be bisexual, but it's not confirmed as of yet. There was a quip where she was like, oh God, am I the only straight person on this team? And America is like, well, you know, with the way you look at me sometimes, I wouldn't necessarily say you're that straight. So it's very interesting. There's a lot of leeway in all of those titles. I'll link to them all from, like, a good-ish starting point for all of them, but definitely check those out. They're probably the best of the best that's going on right now in terms of representation. And, yeah, some of my favorites. So just something a little bit different, rather than telling you the specific storylines there, just giving you a general overview of who the characters and the representation are in there. So it kind of goes all the way across the spectrum there. So yeah. Okay, feedback. So we got a couple of bits of feedback. Let's start off with Jewel, who is back via our Twitter, and says, when we were talking about what we want to see either as another series or or what we want to see coming in those Marvel mystery spots. Jewel actually said, I'd also really like a She-Hulk or Spider-Woman Netflix series, which, you know, I like the idea of She-Hulk just in general, because she essentially is a more humanoid character version of the Hulk. Like, she looks typically female, but she's literally green. She walks around, she's just green, and she becomes a lawyer, and she is a lawyer for, like, essentially superheroes. She's amazing. She's absolutely wonderful. So I would be on board with that. It'd almost be like Nelson and Murdoch, avocados at law. But
I was gonna say, could she team up with Daredevil?
Yeah. Do you want to get the next one?
Sure. Geek Freak also tweeted us and said, great episode, and I agree. So excited for Supergirl this season. So we pretty much just reiterated our excitement in this episode. So go Supergirl.
Yeah. Andrew is back as well and says, not entirely sure why, but your discussion about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Gemma made me cry. # Simmons Fields. Yeah, don't worry, you're not alone. Maybe not our discussion specifically, but that whole thing just made me get very emotional anyway. So if I could hand you a tissue through the internet, Andrew, to dry your tears, I would.
All right, and then Stephanie tweeted us and said, I didn't even hear about Constantine until after it was canceled, so their promotion must have been crap. And then later tweeted us again, oh my god, I love him, he's hilarious. How dare they cancel his show? # save Constantine.
This was the thing I alluded to earlier in the episode of being really mad. NBC actually did do a terrible job with their promotion. Literally the entire thing was left to... The Constantine writers, much like the Arrow writers and Supergirl and Flash ones, had their own Twitter account. And basically, you would only see Daniel Cerrone, who was one of the co-showrunners, and the writing team pushing everything out. Like, they didn't promote it very well. They didn't do much with it at all. They basically put it in their death slot from the start. It was their Friday 10 p.m. show, which they barely do anything with. And they then started shifting it around in the times without really publicizing it very much. So people didn't know it had moved, and then the ratings started fluctuating all over the place. And yeah, they just did such a poor job with this show just in general. And Daniel Cerrone has actually come out and said, you know, I wish we hadn't gone with NBC. It wasn't the right place for it. We had so many great ideas that we were basically kneecapped by the fact that we couldn't do some of them, and it basically stripped back a lot of the story, and it wasn't exactly what we wanted to do. But you know, inherently it wasn't a bad show. It was very, very good. It actually got similar viewer numbers to Arrow and the Flash, which is hilarious. But because it was on NBC, those aren't great numbers for NBC, whereas for the CW they are. So, yeah. I would say, Stephanie, though, go back and watch his show. It's very, very good. I really enjoyed it. It took a couple of episodes to find its stride, as any new show does, but around episode 4-5-ish, I can't remember exactly which one Papa Midnight comes in at, but when Papa Midnight's introduced for the first time, like, it really kicks into high gear and gets amazing. So I highly recommend, even though it was very short-lived, check it out, because it was actually pretty damn good. Yeah. So, question of the week. We figured to give you guys a little bit more time to be creative and come up with more ideas, we will let you carry on with the one that was from our previous episode, which was, what would your campaign slogan be? So we'll carry that on until the next episode. But we do have one reply on that. So Caitlin, do you want to get this one?
Yes. So Cassie replied and said that her campaign slogan would be, Cassie Drake, she will not fail this city. Take a shot, basically. And said, another great episode, ladies. So many feels for S.H.I.E.L.D. 305. # heartbroken. And we're with you.
Yeah, we definitely are. So that's it for another week, guys. Hopefully you enjoyed this episode. As always, if you want to let us know your thoughts on any of the shows, talk to us in general, reply, tell us your quotes of the week, answer our question of the week, anything, you can do so by hitting us up on Twitter, which is at Hero Hype Podcast. Leave us a comment on this post when it goes up on Hyperball, or email us. So that's herohypepodcast@gmail.com. But until the next episode, guys, I'm Danya.
And I'm Caitlin.
And we will see you next week. Bye.
Bye.